Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to Alpha Chat, the business and economics podcast from the Financial Times. I'm Amy Keene. On the show today, a look at the German economy. Germany is often considered an economic role model for the rest of the world, with low unemployment, a strong welfare state, first-class manufacturing, and government budget surpluses. But there's another side to the German economy, and that includes low social mobility and deteriorating infrastructure. And so on a recent trip to Berlin, Matt Klein talked about all of this with economist Marcel Frotscher of the German Institute for Economics Research. Here's the chat.
Marcel Frotscher, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
So what we want to talk about today is Germany's economic performance and providing some additional context to a pretty common narrative that we hear that Germany is really the poster child of how to do government and economics properly compared to either Europe or compared to the United States. You've written several books that cast some doubt on these narratives. I think we can start with just the idea of how has the growth in Germany been distributed over time, say since reunification?
Yeah, there are two important points, really. And first of all, the perception about Germany is Germany is Europe's economic superstar. At least that's how we feel in Germany. You might say that's not difficult if you look at Italy, an economy that has shrunk by 6% since the first quarter of 2008, over the last 10 years. If you look at many other countries in Southern Europe. But the first point really is when you look at today's economic numbers in Germany, where you see the economy is growing, you really need to look at it in the long term. And there the picture looks entirely different. Since beginning of monetary union, since 1999, you can take different points in time too. Over the last, let's say, 20 years, the German economy has grown about 2 to 3% less than the French economy and about 10% less than the Spanish economy. And when I tell people these numbers, they're usually shocked and say, oh, that cannot be. Spain had these deep crises and France is getting everything wrong and they're not doing well economic-wise. I tell them, look, people like to forget that Germany was a sick man of Europe only 10 years ago. So 10 years ago, other countries looked at Germany and said, oh, they did everything wrong. They have high unemployment, 12% unemployment in 2005, fiscal deficits, low productivity growth. And so my point here is Germany is doing well because it's mostly a catching up of a lost decade Germany had in the 2000s. That's the first point. Now, if you look at the distribution, who has benefited from the recent recovery? And if you take a longer term perspective, really surprising or to many surprising feature is that Germany has one of the highest levels of inequality if you look at market income, if you look in particular, if you look at private wealth. But also if you look at social mobility in terms of educational opportunities. And that doesn't sit well with, you know, the thinking of us Germans about ourselves, but also about other Europeans and globally, the US, the perception that they have of Germany. And so one really has to take a closer look. And if you do that, you find a lot of surprising features, such as that inequality is really one key feature of Germany and the inequality is widening.
Speaking of the widening, one of the things that people say that Germany did after its lost decade that has resulted in the catch-up that you described is a series of reforms and changes in the labor market in the early 2000s called either Agenda 2010 or Hartz IV, and the idea that this is the reason why Germany has done better. What is your view on that?
Those tough reforms about 12, 13 years ago, they were certainly helpful for the economic recovery. No question about it. It kind of cut benefits, social security benefits, to those losing jobs or having low income, so really increasing the incentives to work. But it would be really short-sighted to say that was really the only key feature or that was the reason. I think actually it played only a relatively minor role. One is simply a catching up that Germany experienced in recent years. The second is that Germany has benefited massively from emerging market growth, because Germany is a very open economy. It has a very high share of exports relative to the economic size. About 50% is the export to GDP ratio. So about every second job in Germany depends directly or indirectly on exports. And exports have been doing fabulously well. So Germany has this dual economy. On the one hand, very competitive export sectors that have been doing extremely well. On the other hand, mostly services sectors and non-tradables that have had very low investment, very low productivity, and very low wages. So yes, those labor market reforms 10, 15 years ago were important to help bring unemployment down, but they haven't managed to increase productivity. They have not solved the problem that Germany has an unusually large, atypical employment problem. So about 20% in Germany are atypically employed, meaning either very low wages, temporary jobs, or part-time, or a combination of those. Compare that to France, there you have about 10% in that kind of type of employment. You see that Germany really has a big issue here. And so, yes, the Agenda 2010 reforms were helpful, but they have by far not solved the main challenges.
So putting some context on those numbers, it's pretty striking to compare the number of Germans with any kind of job versus the number of total hours worked and tracking that over time. I was looking at this a few months back, and the number of hours worked is higher now than it was in the mid-1990s, but by relatively little, whereas the number of people who have a job is at a record high. And I guess that ties in what you're saying in the rise of part-time employment. The poverty rate has also increased surprisingly during this time, even as GDP has done relatively well. What is your sense of kind of the causes of that?
Part-time employment in Germany has risen a lot because if you look at the labor market miracle that Germany experienced over the last 10 years, it really has three explanations. One is female labor force participation has increased very sharply. Second, huge immigration. And third, a much higher employment among older people, and particularly older people and women tend to work part-time to a much higher share than you find in most other countries. That has to do with the German education system, a very poor educational infrastructure. It has to do with taxation, which penalizes usually the partner in marriages who earns less. So that is one of the big reasons why employment has increased. But the total volume of work, the hours worked, have not increased because you have a lot more part-time. And that's not all voluntary. That's also what one should not forget. A lot of people say they would like to work more. They have to work more. Now, how does that tie in with poverty? So in a way, it seems a contradiction. So a lot more people are working. In a lot of families, you have actually two people working at the same time, and at the same time, poverty rates increasing. And today in Germany, we have about 17% of all citizens living or being affected by poverty. Poverty being defined as a family income that's 60% or less of the median household income. Why has it risen? It has risen partly because wages at the bottom have fallen in real terms. Those 40% in Germany with the lowest wages today experienced a decline in real wages over the last 20 years. So the wage gap has opened up a lot. Wages have not risen overall very strongly, but they have also developed very unequally. So people with high skills, with high wages, have done very well over the last 20 years. But if you're in the bottom 40% with low wages, actually you've seen a decline in real wages. And then the second one is Germany has a strong social welfare state, but it's very biased towards certain families, in particular married couples with children, for instance. Now, if you look at other groups, single parents, for instance, you have a poverty rate that is around about 50%. So every second parent with children lives below the poverty line because they don't get the tax incentives, tax advantages that married couples have. You don't have a decent education infrastructure where you have full day coverage in kindergarten or in primary school. You have high barriers, in particular for women in the labor market. Germany has one of the highest gender pay gaps in the Western world, so women are strongly discriminated, much more strongly than in many other countries. So put all of these factors together and you understand that for certain groups in German society, it's very difficult to make ends meet.
So these changes that have occurred, obviously there are trends that we see in other countries as well, whether it's the United States or the UK, of a divergence in wage patterns. But there was a belief, I think, that Germany was different. It's interesting that it hasn't been different, at least in this respect. To what extent, in your view, is this due to sort of particular factors that Germany experienced, such as reunification and the emergence of sort of the Central and Eastern European countries as a source of relatively low-cost labor on their borders versus policy choices that were made by the German government over time?
I would say the main driver really are policy choices. Reunification doesn't explain that divergent pattern. Yes, there is a big difference between East and West Germany, no question about it. So you have about 78-79% is the income level in the East compared to West Germany. But East Germany has actually been catching up in terms of per capita income, at least for the first 20 years after reunification. This has stalled in recent years, so there's no longer a further convergence, but that's not the explanation why inequality has increased. We find in Germany an increasing south-north divide. So southern Germany is doing incredibly well. That's where you have these typical mid-sized companies that are the backbone of the German economy, family-run, very agile, very mobile, very innovative mid-sized companies, often hidden champions in global markets. That's kind of Bavaria, Baden-Württemberg, the southern states in Germany doing incredibly well. But then you see that the north is doing much less well. And probably the biggest problem state of North Rhine-Westphalia, Germany's most populous state with almost 20 million inhabitants. This is the old industrial West, where you had coal mining, you had iron production, so these type of old industries. And they have not really managed to make that transition very well. So it's not really reunification that explains it. It is also not really European integration, in particular the competition from the East, because that would mean that a lot of jobs were lost going East. But in terms of European integration, in terms of globalization, Germany is really much more of a winner from that development than, let's say, the United States, where you actually have seen quite a number of industrial jobs being lost to other countries. In Germany, we don't have that. So really the problem of the low-wage, precarious type of jobs, these are mostly in non-tradable sectors, in services sectors. Now, if you look at the reasons for that, it has a number of reasons. One is over-regulation. So a very strong protection for certain free professions like lawyers. Now, I don't want to say lawyers are poorly paid, but people working in that sector, if you look at pharmacies, if you look at many other services sectors, they're highly regulated. You have low investment. You have a lot of the low-paid employment in those sectors. So it's not globalization, it's not European integration that has caused that, it's not reunification, but it's really policy choices to have a highly protected services sectors, not enough competition, not enough investment. Second explanation that's equally important is the fundamental transformation of labor market institutions in Germany. So a lot of people think, oh, Germany is highly unionized, very strong labor unions. That used to be the case maybe 30, 40 years ago, but nowadays only every second job is covered by collective bargaining agreements. And those in the low-paid sectors, services sectors, here you have very few jobs that are actually covered by collective bargaining agreements, meaning you have a lot of jobs around the minimum wage. Germany introduced the minimum wage in 2015 at €8.50. That's about, at the current exchange, maybe around about $10. And you had a very large number, almost 10% of all German employees were below that level before the minimum wage was introduced. Now, you would think with the minimum wage, we economists say, oh, this costs a lot of employment. Now, unemployment is going up because companies cannot further employ people at a so much higher wage. But the fact is the minimum wage basically had no impact, no negative impact on employment. It may have in individual cases, of course, but you don't really see that in the numbers at all.
Low investment has been a theme, I guess, of the German economy for quite some, maybe 15 or so years, both on the business side and also on the government sector side. Before we get to the public sector side, which I guess is a slightly a more recent phenomenon, what is your sense of what drove the drop in business and private sector investment basically after 2000? Hmm.
Germany has indeed very low private investment, and that's a puzzle to some. And there are two important factors to mention. One is the fact that there's relatively few private investment in Germany doesn't mean that German companies are not investing a lot. But if you look at the export sectors, industrial sectors, they're investing a lot, but they're investing primarily outside of Germany and less within Germany. Now, from the perspective of individual companies, that may not be a problem. They're just diversifying globally. But if you look at the perspective of German society and the German economy, that is a problem because a lot of good jobs are moving abroad. And ultimately, the risk or the worry that, you know, this trend continues and more good jobs will leave Germany. Now, the second important point to look at is what are the conditions for investment for companies? And if you look at the business conditions, they're actually not that good in Germany. I've been heading an expert committee, an independent expert committee on investment for the German government over the last 4 years. And we basically have found a number of impediments to private investment. You have often very high regulatory barriers. If you need a permission to build a new factory or do something, you need to spend a lot of money and time to get that permission. There is also regulatory uncertainty, for instance, concerning Germany's energy transition. So Germany has committed to moving to renewable energy. So there is a quite high tax surcharge on energy. Now, companies that have a high energy intensity or produce with high energy intensity, they're exempted from that tax. But for the time being, do they know whether they still have that exemption in 3 or 5 or 10 or 20 years' time? So that's a concrete example of regulatory uncertainty where a number of sectors, a number of companies have said, this is too uncertain, that is too risky for us. We are rather moving to the US where energy costs are unusually low. You have other problems in the German labor market in increasing skill shortage. I mentioned Germany has a very low unemployment rate, but equally Germany has a very high number of open jobs. Companies cannot find engineers, programmers, other technical experts. The German economy already for the last 10 years has relied very much on immigration to fill those gaps. Immigration from other European countries. Germany, like the UK, is one of the huge beneficiaries from intra-European migration, getting a lot of young, very well-qualified Europeans coming to Germany and work here. But they can only fill part of that gap. And the labor market shortage because of the demographics in Germany is increasingly becoming a problem for Germany. Taxation is not particularly attractive for German companies. You have a deterioration in the public transport infrastructure. You have one of the worst digital infrastructures in Germany in all of Europe, what a lot of people don't realize. So these are a lot of factors. Infrastructure problems, labor market shortages, high regulatory burdens or regulatory uncertainty, and put all of that together, that's a pretty tremendous impediment for many companies and explains why so many are unwilling to invest in Germany.
So the infrastructure point is particularly interesting because it really cuts against the stereotype that I think exists, at least in the United States, about the nature of Germany with sort of gleaming autobahns and trains that are wonderful. And certainly, at least compared to what's actually in the United States, German infrastructure might very well be better. I don't know. But what you've written about extensively is that actually it may have once been like that, but that it hasn't been this way for a long time. And you're saying, for example, the quality of internet in large parts of Germany is quite poor. Can you give us more of a sense of why that's happened and how it could be fixed?
There are a number of reasons why the conditions, why the public infrastructure and public investment has been relatively weak. Part of it has to do with the federal structure of Germany. So Germany has a very strong federalist structure, maybe not that dissimilar to one you have in the US, but very different from what you have in the UK or France, where you have a very centralized system. It means that more than half of all public investment in Germany is conducted by municipalities. Now, you have a huge heterogeneity across municipalities, with about 30% of them being over-indebted. They ran up debt in the 70s, 80s. They spent too much on admittedly not always very useful investment projects or for social spending, and are over-indebted nowadays, have no flexibility to spend or to even maintain roads or schools or any other public infrastructure that they have to maintain or that's their responsibility. And again, you have a massive south-north divide. So in the south, you have big surpluses in the municipalities. They're investing a lot. In the north, you have sometimes a third or a quarter of that per capita in terms of public investment. Second big reason has to do with the German debt brake. So German government decided about 10 years ago, a bit more than 10 years ago, to introduce a debt brake, which basically means states and municipalities can no longer have deficits. They need to have at least a balanced budget every year or a surplus. For the federal government, it's a tiny structural deficit of 0.35%, so a small deficit. Compare that to the European debt rules, which allow you to have 3% deficit a year, you see that big gap. So a hugely ambitious debt brake in Germany. This, by the way, ignores completely investment. It just says you have to balance your books no matter how you do it. And the way a lot of municipalities, a lot of the states, and also the federal government have been doing it is by cutting investment. And that's the natural thing, right? I mean, if you get into recession, what do you cut first? You cannot cut social spending, and Germany has a very strong social welfare state, so those expenditures go up, so you have to cut on investment. Now, you would think in good times, you turn around and say, now we have to compensate and increase public investment, but that doesn't happen either. And that's a very good example. If you look at the federal German government in the last few years, then the feeling was, oh, now we are doing well. Now we deserve a good increase in social spending. So you increase pensions, you increase all other social security benefits. Public investment gets the lowest priority.
Yeah, it's really remarkable that there's so many municipalities that are forced to cut spending like this, because of course when you take the general government balance and adding up municipal, state, and federal budget, there's a huge surplus right now, and there's been a reasonably large size surplus for almost 10 years. And so it's sort of remarkable that there's nevertheless, because of the structure of how the spending occurs. Where does the other 50% come from? 50% comes from municipalities. Where does the rest of the infrastructure spending come from?
The other half, of course, comes from the states. Also here you have a huge difference between rich states such as Bavaria, Baden-Württemberg, or Hesse, and the northern and the eastern states that tend to have deficits. And, of course, the federal government. Now, the federal government in recent years has offered to help financially. And it has done a bit. It has provided 7 billion euros extra for weak or over-indebted municipalities. That's not bad, but it's about 0.4% of GDP. Not every year, but you know that's once and for all. So we're talking about relatively small numbers. Now, there is really this difficulty that if you look at the general German government, you have big fiscal surplus, but it's so unevenly distributed that the money doesn't end up where it's really needed. And of course, we economists like to talk about incentives, and lawyers like that even more. So one of the big reasons is if you talk to the financially rich states in the south, they say, no way we are going to pay for the guys in Berlin or the northern Germany for, you know, spending all that money on being lazy and not on the right thing. So there is this issue that federalism means you have very independent states or very autonomous states that don't want to share. But ultimately, it doesn't solve the problem that you have increasing also regional inequalities in Germany, and that makes it very difficult to really develop equally, and it causes a huge migration flow within Germany. It causes a lot of problems also in terms of income inequality for individuals. So all of that is linked, and that problem Germany hasn't solved yet.
Do you have any sense of whether there could be, as regional inequality has increased, that there could be a sort of trend towards federalism within Germany to sort of offset that? I mean, even for the debate you described sounds a lot like the debate that Germany has with other countries in the euro area. But putting that aside, just looking at the states within Germany, do you see any kind of shift there on the horizon?
No, not really. That's the depressing thing. So the outgoing German government has done a deal with the states and the municipalities last year on how to reform the financing systems between states and between the federal government, and basically didn't change anything. So the agreement is the federal government is giving a bit more money, but ultimately it doesn't really change anything. And that's kind of the depressing outcome that will haunt Germany for the next 20, 30 years if it doesn't change course. It doesn't solve the problem for the over-indebted municipalities. And there is no willingness really for radical solutions either. What I find intriguing is, because you made the parallel to Europe, look, in Europe we are talking about Greece, and it's clear to everyone that Greece needs the haircut, right? Debt is too high, it's not sustainable, you can't have that kind of level of debt, and you need to lighten the load for Greece so that it can, you know, after it exits the third rescue program now in August, that it can continue and that it attracts investment, that private investors are coming in. And no one has asked whether we shouldn't have a haircut and debt forgiveness for German municipalities, because it's the same issue. They're over-indebted. They don't have the autonomy. They don't have the ability to actually spend wisely, invest in the infrastructure, invest in schools and other things to improve the economic lot. And that's, I kind of find it intriguing that we're talking about Greece and a haircut for Greece, but not within Germany.
Who holds most of that municipal debt? Is it like local banks, or who are the main investors there who would have to take the loss?
It basically has an implicit state or federal guarantee. So it's mostly held by domestic banks, by the local savings banks that play a very important role. There is a fair bit of financial repression, but it seems to serve everyone. So Germany's banking sectors, also because of that very close relationship between politics and the local savings banks, is not the most efficient one, not the most profitable one. But so long as this is rolled over continuously, which it is, it doesn't pose a major problem.
Well, put another way, what would, you know, if there were going to be a significant write down in these debts to free up municipalities to make new investments, what would be the rough size of those debts that you'd want to see restructured?
Oh, that's a good question. I can't give you an exact figure. The debt of the municipalities, of course, is not nearly as high as let's say, the federal debt. That is much, much higher. But it has accumulated. And the problem for municipalities is not only the level of debt. So as I said, it's not that gigantic. But the problem is that they don't really have many sources of revenues. So they basically rely on two taxes, on the local tax on companies that want to locate there, and things like the local tax on housing, so real estate charge on the value of the house, which is tiny because the values are not accurate. But so it's very difficult for the municipalities to generate revenues, and therefore even the relatively what looks like a moderate level of debt for them is very hard to serve.
You mentioned that the tax on housing is an understated, and I think this is a good chance to get into the wealth inequality within Germany. And part of that is significantly due to housing, in the sense that the homeownership rate in Germany is quite low. And arguably, that wasn't really an issue for a long time because conditions for renters were pretty good. But sort of in the past 10 years, that's changed. Can you kind of give us more detail on that and how that evolved?
One of the striking features about Germany is that Germany has the highest level of wealth inequality in all of the euro area. Yes, you have higher wealth inequality in the UK and the US, but Germany really has an unusually large degree of inequality on wealth. What is even more striking, even compared to the US and the UK, is that you have about 40% of German households that have no net wealth whatsoever. So that's even larger than what you have in the US. And then you can ask, so where does it come from? One is to describe it. It has to do with very low home ownership in Germany. Only 45% of citizens actually have home ownership, compared to 70, 80, 85% in countries like UK or some of the southern European countries. If they don't hold housing, what do they do with the wealth? So one point is that Germans are terribly poor savers, have very low equity ownership, with actually declining trend, about 7 to 8% of citizens only holding equities. So they like to hold their savings in a saving account or in a life insurance, which basically yields a negative interest rate currently. On top of it, German banks have been being spectacularly bad in investing German savings abroad, in American subprime, in real estate in Spain or Ireland. In the 1990s already, in the big M&A wave, where German companies, German banks bought to completely inflated prices American startup and high-tech companies. So German banks, German investors have been quite poor over the last 25 years investing those savings abroad. It also has to do with the tax system. So in Germany, income on labor is taxed relatively strongly. Income on wealth or wealth itself is hardly taxed. So tax revenues from wealth, from different types of wealth taxes in the UK or in the US, is close to 4% of GDP. In Germany, it's 1/4 of that. It has a number of reasons. As I said, property is basically not really taxed. The basis for taxing home ownership is in East Germany based on calculations from 1935, in West Germany from 1963. So clearly based on numbers that are completely unrealistic.
They've never bothered to update those.
Oh, there are good reasons not to update them, because then you would actually have to calculate the true value, and then you get in a whole, you know, then taxes, of course, would go up. You have equally on a big issue in Germany is inheritance tax. You have that tax. It's about, at the maximum, you have a kind of a free amount, what you can inherit up to a certain amount. Then it goes up to 25%. The fact is that Germans inherit every year around about 400 billion euros. That's about 13-14% of GDP that passes across generations every year. Tax revenues from that is about 1%, so 4-5 billion. Because inheritance in terms of firms, of family-run firms, are usually entirely exempt from that. So the rules are, if you inherit the company from someone, your parents, grandparents, whoever, and you keep running that company for 7 years without reducing the employment or the wage bill, you basically, after 7 years, you're off the hook entirely. You pay zero. And in fact, that's, you know, people inheriting of more than 10 million pay less than 1% inheritance tax. Those inheriting maybe 400,000 or 500,000, so maybe a small flat or something, they usually pay an average more than 10% inheritance tax. So they have this tax system that is very favors people who have wealth. It really penalizes people who have labor. That contributes to an increasing inequality, both in wealth and, of course, and also in income, and is a big factor in Germany.
It's interesting because there's also a perception, and it's borne out in the aggregate data, but obviously when you disaggregate the data, it looks different. But the aggregate data show that German households are very aggressive savers. And even if they invest badly in mostly, you know, negative yielding instruments, they save supposedly, you know, double digit percentages of their income. And yet you have a situation where 40% of Germans have no savings whatsoever. So how does that, or no assets, I should say, do you have a sense of sort of how the inequality in income, inequality in savings rate plays out, and who's actually doing the bulk of that saving?
Clearly, people with good income in Germany are able to save a lot, and they save a lot. So in some sense, the saving rate is very much a reflection of income inequality and wealth inequality on top. The difficulty, of course, is that you have a high correlation between income and wealth. People with high income tend to be people with high wealth. That leads me to the third type of inequality, which is low social mobility. So in Germany, your ability to get a good education and a good income depends much more on two factors, namely income of your parents and education level of your parents, than in almost every other country in the world. In the Western world, I should say. So that dependence in Germany is almost as strong or even stronger than what you have in the U.S. About the U.S., it's not surprising. We all know, you know, if you're born in a wealthy, well-educated family, your chances are much better. You have a private education system. You have excellent schools that cost money in the U.S. In Germany, it's mostly public schools, so free education is for free. So it's even more surprising that you have the same low degree of social mobility in Germany as you have in the United States. And Part of it has to do with the education system that gives the parents a lot of importance in a big role. You don't have full-day schools, or very few. Usually much of the education is done at home. You don't have a very good early childhood education system in Germany. Still, that's improving, but it's a mentality issue, which is changing very slowly. They reinforce each other and basically explain also why some groups in society are able to build up savings and wealth. And so the worry is that over time, that gap will become larger.
Speaking of education and mobility and its rising importance, I have a quote here, which I think is based on your writing, which is that Germany is one of the few countries in the Western world where the share of young men completing a university degree is actually going down. Can you give us more kind of context on that and what both the numbers and also what's driving it?
In Germany, we have a relatively low enrollment in university compared to most other Western countries. If you talk to most Germans, they're very proud of that. They say, oh, not everyone needs to go to university. We are very proud of our dual education system. So the dual education system means we actually have three different layers of high school, and you decide very early on, or rather the teachers decide for you, which of the tracks you take. And if you take a lower track, you usually finish school at the age of 15 or 16, and then you go into a vocational training, which means you decide what kind of job you want to do. If you want to become, let's say, a mechanic, you're employed by a company that trains you as a mechanic. You have on top of it 2 days a week, you have a specific school that trains you on technical details, and then you become a mechanic. Then you have, by the age of 19, a finished degree, and usually the company keeps employing you, and you have a long-term perspective. So the good thing of that is that it's very practical, that it trains young people very well, and youth unemployment in Germany is unusually low. So it's hardly higher than the overall average. So that's a success. Now, my worry about that is more in the long run, right? So we know that people who specialize very early on find it much harder to retrain, or especially when they become unemployed, to do something new.
There is some good news in the German economy, though. I don't want to make it sound like we're just being negative the entire time. There's been, in the past few weeks, news of wage negotiations with big unions like IG Metall and others. And while union coverage has fallen by about half, as you mentioned, they've negotiated several relatively impressive wage increases and also the potential for working significantly fewer hours than they have in the past. What is your sense of this? And, you know, is this sort of the beginning of a real trend? What should we make of this as people looking at sort of the German wage outlook?
I'm sorry that I sound too negative on Germany. I didn't want to sound too critical.
It's my question. Don't worry.
I mean, I mentioned the success stories that Germany has very low unemployment, and that's, of course, important. Now, if you look at the recent weeks and the wage negotiations, one should not misinterpret that. The IG Metall, these are industrial jobs that are paid incredibly well. These are among the best paid industrial jobs. They have quite a significant increase in wages now, and also allow workers to reduce working time temporarily. I don't see this translate into equally strong wage increases across the board for other sectors. Second point is where one shouldn't overestimate it is that what's very interesting is that labor unions or labor contracts in the past few years have always been backward looking on inflation. And inflation has been, like most other European and Western countries, been very low, but it's picking up now in Germany. And so the real wage increases are actually not that impressive. We are expecting somewhere between 1.5%, around about a 1.5% real wage increases this year and maybe also next year. So this is not bad. But if you take into account that during the 2000s, real wage increases actually have been negative on balance, on average, we see that Germany is still in a catching up period. So yes, real wages are increasing, but not very much. Germany, there's some concern about overheating, the economy doing well, wages increasing, the labor market basically being so, you know, unemployment being so low. I'm quite relaxed about that. I don't see really an overheating for the German economy. For one, because wage increases are absolutely in line with the long-term trend, with long-term productivity. Second, because migration continues to be very strong. Third, because we know inflation is not just driven by domestic factors, but global factors are becoming increasingly important to determine inflation also in Germany. So I think Germany will have another 3 to 4 golden economic years ahead of it, with increasing employment, increasing wages, strong exports, strong increase in income for the great majority of citizens.
There's also a case to be made, and I'm not saying you should make it, but there is a case to be made that some overheating within Germany would actually be beneficial within the context of Germany's position as part of a larger monetary union, insofar as you're mentioning, in the basically the period up until 2007, 2008, Germany had unusually weak wage growth, and Germany had unusually weak investment, and ended up, as a result, being a drag on overall euro area growth that was offset by robust growth in places such as Spain. In the period since then, when Spain has undergone sort of a small depression and it's recovered recently, but it still, in general, has had a significant contraction, one would think there would be an opportunity for a certain symmetry there within Germany. It looks like that we still have a ways to go before that's even on the table. There could be a case, a positive case, for actually saying a little bit of overheating would be desirable from sort of a euro area wide perspective.
I would say overheating is never good, because the problems you get with an overheating economy over the medium to long term always outweigh the benefits, the short term benefits. Now, I wouldn't agree that Germany has been a drag on the euro area. Yes, I know a number of people have argued Germany should have, you know, increased spending more, in particular on the fiscal side, in recent years. I'm a little bit skeptical on that for a number of reasons. First of all, Germany's economy is booming because of exports from Asia in particular. So in that kind of situation, on top of it, to have a fiscal stimulus is just not good economic policy. Second, one also shouldn't forget that even from a very strong expansion in Germany, the spillover to other euro area economies, it's not zero, but it's relatively modest. So it would not be a game changer, let's say, for Italy if now in Germany you had 0.5% percentage points more growth. Third thing that I often find a bit troubling with the argument of in other European countries is the idea, oh, because Germany has low wages, we, the other countries, cannot compete with Germany. And that's why it's a beggar thy neighbor policy. And Christine Lagarde, when she was French finance minister, talked about a wage dumping that is being done in Germany. Kind of that I do not agree with. I don't think this is really an adequate description, because it assumes that German companies are competing with French or Italian companies. Yes, there are certain instances, but by and large, German companies are actively globally. They're competing more with American or Chinese or Korean or Japanese companies. So my point is Germany should have invested more. It should have had a better economic policy, but mainly for its own sake, rather than for the other Europeans. So I always say the big current account surplus, trade surplus that Germany has, current account surplus of more than 8% of GDP, reducing that via higher investment and higher imports would help other European countries, but it would help Germany first and foremost, and Germany would be the main beneficiary from it. So Germany should do it for its own sake, not for its neighbors.
Right, for all of the German workers who have nevertheless under the poverty line, and those with low assets, this would be beneficial for them more than anyone else. It would also happen to have positive benefits for Germany's neighbors. One thing we touched on briefly before we close is that you mentioned that the rate of taxation on German workers, especially at the low end, is unusually high, both the actual tax on employment and then the implied tax rate as benefits are withdrawn. Do you see that as something that could be changed as part of the or these other policies mentioned it being changed as part of the coalition of negotiations?
Yes, and one that should be changed. In Germany, the discussion has been now with the coalition agreement, we have such a big fiscal surplus. How can we spend it? We need to spend the money. And every party had its own interest group and clientele they had to serve. And so there was an agreement now to cut the income tax, kind of it's an income tax surcharge called the Soli, which is basically paid by 90% is paid for by the richest one third. That will happen after 2021. So that's a compromise. It's very expensive. That's about 20 billion annually if you cut that tax entirely, 0.6-0.7% of GDP. Now, it would be very easy to cut taxes for the poorer half of the society, either by reducing social security contributions for pensions, for healthcare is unusually high in Germany. Cutting these social security contributions would also help make workers more attractive for companies to hire, because it would lower the cost of labor, and would also improve the incentives for work, get more people from part-time into full-time or working more hours. So a wise and a good economic policy would really focus on reducing taxation and social security contributions for the people with middle and smaller incomes, so that they would really have incentives to work more, thereby having equally on the demand side but also on the supply side positive effects, increasing potential growth and therefore having higher long-term growth. Another option would be to cut value-added tax, and something we have proposed at DIW is say, look, if you really want to everyone to benefit, in particular proportionally to their income, people with low income, you should cut VAT, because that goes straight into their pockets. Politically, of course, that's a non-starter, because as a politician, you want to, you know, you want to get people hug you and love you. And if you cut the VAT, no one will thank you, because people won't really realize that they have more money in the pocket at the end of the month.
That's interesting. I would have thought actually that cutting VAT would be very popular, but I guess it's not a surcharge you see at the end when you get your bill, like a sales tax. So have politicians in general been receptive to these ideas? I guess not VAT, but the other ones that you've been mentioning. Do you see there being sort of real momentum for these kind of reforms?
No, on taxation, I think this is one of the weakest points of the coalition agreement. There's basically just spending increases in the coalition agreement, but no thinking we actually need to also make the tax system more efficient. One of the big problems for people with small and medium incomes is that you have marginal tax rates of 80 to 90%. So meaning if you work a bit more, you have a higher labor income, actually some of the public subsidies are removed. And so it's very unattractive for you to push to work more hours or get a different job with a better income. And simplifying the tax system, providing better incentives, lowering not just the marginal but the overall tax rates for people with a small and medium income, that should be a main priority. And politically, that's not very popular, apparently. So that would be a sad thing, that I don't expect the new coalition government to really tackle that issue.
Marcel Frascher, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for your time.
And that's the end of this week's show. Thanks for listening. Let us know what you think. You can email us at alphachat@ft.com. Please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts. It really helps others find out about us. Thanks to Matt and to Marcel for this week's conversation. We'll see you here next week for another episode of Alpha Chat.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.